to WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
So these imperialists, together with the Christian Zionists and the early Jewish Zionists, began to push for a change in British policy, persuading the British government that it would serve the British imperial interest to tear out of the Ottoman Empire parts of the Arab world, including Palestine, and in the case of Palestine, build a Jewish European state for the Jews that Europe didn't want. These ideas that became a real policy, despite its immorality, its in many ways impracticality, but nonetheless established new facts on the ground. So this historical context is very relevant to what goes on today.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel claims that there is no need for explanations as to why Hamas attacked on October 7th, 2023. Historian Ilan Pape challenges that point of view. He says that without historical contextualization, the issues are not only incomprehensible, but also make people vulnerable to half-truths and propaganda. For decades, corporate media coverage of the conflict has been lopsided in Israel's favor. Israelis are humanized, Palestinians are demonized. Ilan Pape points out that the Israel-Palestine conflict didn't start on October 7th, nor did it start with the 1917 Balfour Declaration or with 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, or in 1948, when the State of Israel was declared. Roots of the conflict began in 1882, when the first Zionist settlers arrived in what was then Turkish-controlled Palestine. Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. He spoke in Exeter, England in January 2026. And now, Ilan Pape.
I was asked to answer a very important question, which is why do we need to talk about the history of Palestine and Gaza in order to understand the reality today and have some understanding of what awaits us in the near and more distant future. History here is important because in many ways we are still in the same historical chapter that started with the arrival of the Zionist movement in Palestine in the late 19th century. It's not surprising that Palestinian historians and activists and thinkers call the whole period from 1882 until today the ongoing catastrophe or the ongoing Nakba, or as the historian Rashid Khalidi preferred to call it, the ongoing war on Palestine. So we are in a chapter that actually has history, but we are still part of that history. And understanding that history is something that when it is presented to people with a modicum of decency in them, immediately puts them on the side of the victims, of the colonized, of the victims of ethnic cleansing, of the oppressed. This is one of the reasons that, especially after the 7th of October 2023, but even before that, official spokesperson for Israel, were very adamant that historical context should not be mentioned when you discuss Israel and Palestine. This was a particular important position for them after the 7th of October 2023. You might all remember that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Guterres, although he condemned the acts of the Hamas on the 7th of October, immediately said that we should understand that these acts were not done in a vacuum, which he meant they were done within a historical context. Israel's response was to demand that he would be fired. He would be removed from his position as Secretary General. And this was followed by a very assertive kind of campaign by Israel and its allies, especially in Europe, but also in parts of the United States, to demand that in academic centers, people would not discuss the events of the 7th of October within a historical context. The worst case was Germany, where academics were told by their university management in a very straightforward way, do not mention context. If you mention context when you discuss the events of the 7th of October, you might be accused of anti-Semitism or of supporting terrorism. And I think that the Israelis are, in that respect, are right, as I said before, because the context enable us to have a sophisticated position on the question of Palestine. It also allows us to understand the connection between a one-off event like the 7th of October and our moral and historical judgment of the whole process that brought with it both the events of the 7th of October, but also the Israeli genocidal reaction to them. So in a way, when we are discussing the historical context, in some places, especially in the northern, in the global north or in the west, can be described as subversive, as I said, almost tantamount to supporting terrorism or bordering on anti-Semitism. I want to explain how the historical context became a kind of a contentious subject between those who try to defend the Israeli actions on the ground after the 7th of October and those of us who want to put the 7th of October and particularly the genocide that followed it within a historical context that allows us to understand how we got into this horrible moment in the history of modern Palestine, and what does it tell us, at least tentatively, about the future. Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was mainly referring to the 17 years of siege. The Israeli imposed a siege and blockade on Gaza, and he wanted to say, you know, although I don't justify what happened, but that's a reaction for people living in the conditions of a maximum security jail or a ghetto or a prison camp. And they broke out of the prison in a way. But in fact, in order to understand both that reality and its future, you have to go back in time, not just to the beginning of the Israeli siege on Gaza that began in 2007. I claim that in order to have a full understanding of what we are facing now and what we are going to face in the future, you have to go to the very origin of the Zionist project. And this is something that is not easy to convey within mainstream media, not only because the mainstream media's position on Israel or Palestine, but also because of the nature of mainstream media that doesn't have the space or the span of attention to have a more elaborate discussion of current events in order to understand them better and to expose the real motives behind certain actions and prepare for what can come next. So I would suggest that in order to understand the last 2.5 years in Gaza, you have to go to the very early formative period of Zionism. And it's important to remind ourselves that Zionism was a European project before it was a Jewish one. And because it was a European project for a very long time, not only when it was conceived, but also it was a European idea to maintain it and its moment of needs. Because of that, I think we begin to understand one of the most bewildering aspects of what happened in the last 2.5 years, and this is the European political elites at best indifference to the genocide and at worst complicity with the genocide. After all, Israel in their eyes was something that especially Western Europe helped to establish, so as organically connected to it, and therefore any confrontation with Israel is a confrontation with a West European country. And Europe is willing to confront Russia, it is willing to confront every other country in the world, but it will never apply the same kind of yardsticks for behavior or policies or criminal policies to a Western European country in this respect. It began as a European project. In fact, it began as a Christian European project. Certain sections of evangelical Christianity were the first one in modern times, in the very beginning of the 19th century, to bring up the idea that there should be a European and even American support for what they called the return of the Jews to the Holy Land in order to precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the end of time. They were joined in the mid-19th century by a group of Jewish intellectuals, thinkers, activists, who were desperate about the inability of a large section of Europe to accept the Jews in the continent as indigenous people, and saw them as aliens, as a distinct race, as a different nation even. And therefore, together with these early Christian Zionists, if you want, they began to develop a vision of a Jewish state in Palestine as a solution for the fact that they saw no hope for any fundamental change in the position of European societies and countries towards the European Jews. We have to remember the two things happened in the second half of the 19th century that contributed to the consolidation of these ideas. One was the rise of nationalism. We usually call 1848 as the time of the Spring of Nations. And these new European nations, they needed the other that is not part of the nation to define more clearly what the nation is. And the Jews were a very convenient scapegoat for defining modern nationalism, whether it was Polish, Romanian, Serbian, you name it. It was easier to know who is a real Pole, who is a real Romanian, who is a real German by saying, well, they're definitely not Jews. And the Jewish intellectuals themselves began to internalize this idea and say, well, maybe they're right. Maybe Judaism is a separate nationalism, a separate race, and we deserve a homeland of ourselves. We can't have it in Europe. And it was very clear from the support they got from certain Christian institutions that they would try and help them with the political elites to establish a European state in the heart of at the heart of the Arab world with the help of Europe. Now, all these ideas were very theoretical until it also caught the attraction of British imperialists. There was a lobby within the British government in the last half of the the second half of the 19th century, that was unhappy with the British policy of not adding any more colonies to the empire, and particularly with the policy that said Britain should not try to take over possessions that belonged to the Ottoman Empire, which included Palestine, in order not to push for the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire that could lead to a European war, which in fact is what happened once Britain deserted this policy of keeping the Ottoman Empire together. So these imperialists began to push, together with the Christian Zionists and the early Jewish Zionists, for a change in British policy. And the moment they succeeded in persuading the British government that it would serve the British imperial interest to tear out of the Ottoman Empire parts of the Arab world, including Palestine, and in the case of Palestine, build a Jewish European state for the Jews that Europe didn't want, this ideas that might have seemed, and they did seem to many people, including to many Jews, as immoral, impractical, became a strategy, became a real policy on the ground, despite its immorality, its in many ways impracticality, but nonetheless established new facts on the ground. And that history is important because I think to this very day, European intellectuals and academics, and this includes also Americans, because America was later involved in it also directly, did not come back to a very important moment in history. And that moment was immediately after the Holocaust in 1945, when European intellectuals and leaders had a chance of saying to European Jews, because most of the Jews who were in Palestine as settlers were Europeans. There were very few settlers who came from Arab countries or Muslim countries. Didn't say to these settlers, who were about 500,000, please come back to Europe. Our answer to the Holocaust is to build a Europe that would not allow a genocide of anyone, not just Jews, because in the Second World War, not only Jews were genocided. Millions of other people were genocided. We will build another Europe that would make it your home because it is your home. And forsake this colonial project that you built together with Britain, which was only, 40, 45 years old. Not one European intellectual, not one American intellectual, not one European or American leader. But I think we should, at that moment, focus on Europe. America was not as important then to that story as yet. Not one European intellectual, not one European leader said, this is how we're going to build post-Holocaust Europe. No. They all said, what a wonderful idea. The best solution for preventing a European genocide of Jews again is to send them all to Palestine and let them colonize the Palestine and dispossess the Palestinians. This is something that is not ancient history, and this is not something that has been resolved as yet. I'm still expecting European leaders today, European governments, to say to Israeli Jews of European origin, you are welcome back home, even if you are third generation. Of course, they don't have to go. I'm not saying that this is a solution for the Palestine question. I'm talking about a symbolic, significant closure to the terrible idea that Palestinians had to pay the price for the fact that Europe didn't know how to deal with its racism towards Jews. And because it didn't know how to deal with racism towards Jews, it's not surprising that it doesn't know how to deal today with its racism towards African, Arabs, and Muslims. So this historical context is very relevant to what goes on today. Now, of course, there is a more immediate historical context, which you cannot forget, especially when we talk about the Gaza Strip. And this has to do with the fact that this European project, built on the bayonets of the British Army, eventually was powerful enough in 1948 to deal with one of the two most important challenges that faced this idea of solving the problem of European Jews by building a European Jewish state at the heart of the Arab world. One challenge was that not all the Jews in the world agreed that this was the solution. And Israel tried to solve it by claiming to be the state of all the Jews and used a lot of energy and propaganda. And I'm not sure that in historical perspective they succeeded, but time will tell. But the second challenge was the more important one. How do you turn Palestine into a Jewish state when the majority of the people are Palestinians and there are the indigenous people? And in 48, there were the circumstances that allowed Israel to try and change dramatically the demography of Palestine by ethnically cleansing half of the indigenous population, by destroying 500, which were half of their villages, and demolishing most of their urban spaces. And in that project of ethnic cleansing, and I'm not sure how many people are aware of it, the Gaza Strip was created. There was no Gaza Strip before 1948. Gaza was organically connected to the rest of Palestine. It was a very pastoral place, both the city and Han Yunis, which was the second largest town. And then there were the other villages, very fertile, very rich agriculture and trade centers connecting Egypt with Syria and further afield Turkey, and being in family, blood, social and cultural and political connection with every other important town and center in Palestine, whether it was Jaffa, Acre, Haifa, or Jerusalem and Nablus and Halil, Hebron. Israel created the Strip because it had a problem of what to do with hundreds of thousands. In fact, 200,000, the exact number was. There were 200,000 Palestinians which Israel found difficult to find a new place for them after kicking them out from their villages and towns. The other 550,000 Palestinians Israel had expelled in 1948 were pushed towards Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. These 200,000 were meant to be pushed forcefully by Israel into Egypt, but Egypt did not allow them to cross the border into the Sinai. So David Ben-Gurion, the Israeli prime minister, found a solution. He said, we can give up 2% of Palestine, 360,000 square kilometers, and push the refugees into that strip that we will create with the agreement of the Egyptian government, and actually turned it into the largest ever refugee camp in the world. In Gaza were 80,000 indigenous Gazans, if you want, and they had to absorb within 3 months 200,000 people. Of course, they had no infrastructure, no way of doing it. And Gaza became one of the most dense populated enclaves in the world. So that is also part of the story, because 70% of the Palestinians in Gaza are descendants of these people who were expelled. And many of them were expelled from villages on whose land and whose ruins some of the Jewish settlements that were attacked on the 7th of October were built. And this also gives you some sort of a context that is important for understanding what happened, not necessarily justifying everything, but giving you a good idea of what was happening. And of course, even a more recent context are the years of Israeli occupation since 1967. And in particular, and I think this is something that, again, mainstream media either doesn't have the patience to mention or doesn't want to mention, is the fact that life in Gaza in particularly became unbearable already in 1994. Ironically, as a result of the peace effort, as a result of the Oslo Accord. This is, by the way, also true about the West Bank. But in Gaza in particular, life after 1993 was far worse than life between 67 and 1994. Israel encircled the Gaza Strip with a barbed wire in 1994, limited the number of Palestinians who could work in Israel, and increased the power of the settlers, who were only a few thousands, allowing them to take over water sources, fertile land, and created with them wedges between Palestinian and this very, very, very dense and small piece of land, and made the ability to move around, to shop, to visit family, to find work, much more difficult than it was before 1994, which meant that unemployment was on the rise, and with it also the determination not to give in to such a way of life, especially when that way of life was produced by a false promise of peace and a different reality, which of course Israel never meant genuinely to fulfill when it signed the papers of the Oslo Accord in 1993. And it's not surprising that for the people of Gaza since 1994, the organizations, the outfits that they felt deserved their support were not judged by their ideology or by their ideological visions of the future. They were judged by their willingness to confront this life in the largest ever refugee camp that incrementally became one of the largest prison camps in the world. And the support went to those who opposed the Israeli occupation and not for those who decided to find a kind of a collaboration with Israel with the hope that this would somehow serve themselves maybe, but also their own people by securing some sort of pacification of life, I mean the Palestinian Authority. This is important to understand because the Israeli narrative of the 7th of October and also their justification for what they did after the 7th of October is that actually this whole operation was instigated by Iran. It's part of an Islamist attack on Jews or the state of Israel, on the West as a whole, totally ignoring, of course, on purpose, the fact, the explanation for the support for the political Islamic groups, for their ascendance, for the agenda that they had on the 7th of October, which included one of the most important issues, included the probably what most Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip would regard as the most sacred issue, the issue of the political prisoners, hoping that abduction would lead to a prisoner exchange, miscalculating the Israeli government's indifference to the fate of the hostages taken by the Hamas, and also the wish to break out of the kind of prison Israel created in 2007 with the policy of blockade and siege that turned, as I said, the biggest refugee camp in the biggest maximum security prison on earth. And to this, of course, you could add the international community focusing on the Ukraine and not paying attention to what was going on in Palestine, which was not just a problem of a shifting attention. It was a problem of hypocrisy. The way that Ukrainians were praised for their actions, while similar actions by Palestinians were prescribed as terrorist and Islamist and fanatic.
You're listening to Ilan Pape on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
So all this is important. And it also tells you something about the viciousness and the callousness of the Israeli actions after the 7th of October. It is important to say that, of course, and I don't want to deny it, that this was a traumatic moment for the Israeli society. The way people were killed, the kind of people who were killed, although we don't know until today how many were killed by the Israeli army, how many were brutally killed by Palestinians, how many died as soldiers in fighting Palestinian guerrillas. All this is not very clear, but no doubt it was a traumatic moment, and there was a sense of revenge, and part of the action was response to the kind of things that happened on the ground. But it's very clear that it turned very quickly into a different kind of operation, which had behind it an ideology and a strategy. And I think it goes back to the 1948 ethnic cleansing from a different angle. If you look at the 1948 ethnic cleansing in a very cynical way, you can say it was not successful because half of the Palestinians remained in Palestine and many millions of Palestinians remained close to Palestine. And in the refugee camp, the Palestinians, contrary to what Zionist leaders thought would happen, did not forget and did not die without passing to the next generation the desire to liberate Palestine, to fight for its liberation. So in that respect, as terrible as the ethnic cleansing of 48 was, it was also incomplete. And it was also incomplete because Israel, for its own, I don't have time to go into it, for all kinds of strategic reasons, decided not to occupy the West Bank in 48, although it had all the power to do that. So when they did complete the occupation of the whole of historical Palestine in 1967, they incorporated, again, a large number of Palestinians, almost the same number of Palestinians that they had expelled in 1948, which is another reason why a certain stream of Zionism that began to develop in Israel, which I call Neo-Zionism, the Messianic Zionism, felt that it had the power to rectify the mistakes, the so-called mistakes, of the previous Zionist leadership in 1948 and in 1967. And these people, who were quite on the margins of Israeli politics until the 21st century, are now dominating Israel. They took over the educational system, the cultural system, the political system, the army, the police, the secret service. And they have a very clear idea of how to rectify which they think was a mistake in 1948, namely not to expel all the Palestinians and take over the whole of Palestine. In fact, not just the whole of Palestine, but also parts of what they think was the ancient biblical Israel, namely Jordan and some parts of South Lebanon and South Syria. These people that used to be regarded in Israel a bit as lunatics are now the powers that be in Israel. And they were already the powers that be in November 2022. And they are the ones who, without any inhibitions, turned the Israeli reaction to the 7th of October into a genocide campaign. In many ways, you can say historically that Israel is transformed from being a settler colonial state, and it's not the only settler colonial state. You are now living in a settler colonial state. Israel's turned it from a settler colonial state into a genocidal state. And a genocidal state has to be confronted morally and legally and in aspect of legitimacy in a very, even in a more different way than a settler colonial state. But of course, the international community, the political elites at least, are not yet absorbing this, digesting it, or are willing to act. But I think we should be with open eyes to understand that the current political elite, and it doesn't matter what would be the results of the elections in April 26 in Israel, the current political elite is determined to continue what it started in Gaza in the last 2 years and move with it to the West Bank, then to the Palestinian community inside Israel, and expand the Israeli territorial space beyond the boundaries of historical Palestine. Now, I would like to say that, first of all, I don't think they will succeed. I'm just talking about plans. And secondly, I think that this is an indication of something that could make us optimistic about the future. this total exposure of the project that you could have conveyed or commodified, if you want, in the past as an ambiguous project of democracy and human rights and civil rights and salvaging Jews on the one hand, with unfortunately the need to colonize, occupy, and ethnically cleansing. The whole idea of the Jewish democratic state, as if it's possible to have a racist state that also adheres to principles of democracy and universal values. But somehow the West, in particular the political elites in the West, especially the left in the West, was very happy with this idea that yes, you could somehow square this circle. This is gone because the people in Israel who subscribe to these ideas are also the enemies of the new neo-Zionist messianic elite that took over Israel. They're also the enemies, not only the Palestinians. And they don't seem to fight back. They seem to emigrate instead of fighting back. Some of them are fighting back. You can see it on the streets of Tel Aviv. But I don't think they have a chance of winning. This will expose Israel as a genocidal state, which means in the short term, we are very worried of what it's going to do. And as always, the immediate victims of their fanaticism, racism, and extremism are the Palestinians themselves. However, it must, because it happened before in history, wake up many more people to understand that this is a state that should be treated as a pariah state, that this is a state that doesn't have internal dynamics of change. And that requires a different regional and international reaction. Now, I know we have political elites in the region and in the international community who would do nothing about this. I don't have to tell you this, but I'm an historian and I'm not impressed by stills. I'm impressed by videos. I don't think the picture we see today, populist leaders in America, populist fascist leaders in Europe, rulers rather than leaders in the Arab world, in other parts, in the global south, are the future. I think what Gaza did, it took millions of people of civil society out to the streets, not just because of Gaza, but because of the essence of politics that they are facing in their own countries, facing their own ecological, social, economic injustices in their countries or in the world. And yes, this massive solidarity with Palestine that goes beyond the issue of Palestine, as we've seen from the millions who demonstrated in Italy, for instance, has not yet been translated in any infrastructural way, organizational way, institutional way, to become a counterforce to populism, fascism, racism. I will finish by saying that we are at the juncture in history where if you see Gaza as the epicenter for a while, and epicenters do change. Vietnam could be an epicenter. South Africa was an epicenter. Central America was epicenter. Gaza was the epicenter in the last 2 years. And seen from that epicenter, you can see two global coalitions confronting each other. And we should hope that we are part of the coalition that I think that would win the day eventually, but not immediately, unfortunately. So one is the global Israel. Global Israel are all these members of the alliance that see even a messianic, racist, fanatic, extreme Israel as serving their interest. Maybe these are Christian Zionists who believe that this is just getting them even nearer to the return of the Messiah and the end of time. Maybe these are multinational corporations that believe that Israel's high-tech ability brings them dividends. Maybe, surely it is, military industry and security industries, maybe oil industries, who think that Israel is a bonanza rather than a liability. And Jewish communities who still regard Israel as an insurance state, although this is ridiculous because the only place where Jews are being killed in high numbers is in Israel. Nonetheless, even those who are cynically support Israel, not ideologically or morally, would find out that the kind of Israel that we have now, which I call in my last book, the State of Judea, I don't think we have Israel anymore. We have the State of Judea. This State of Judea would make it difficult even to be a worthy investment for members of that coalition that now see it as bringing dividends, mostly financial, maybe strategic dividends. It is faced by global Palestine. Global Palestine is all these networking, intersectional networking between trade unions, indigenous minorities, oppressed minorities, people who fight for ecological justice and economic justice, people who understand that without credible international legal system, you cannot create global cooperation to face global warming, poverty, immigration in any effective way. This is global Palestine, and global Palestine took out millions in an unprecedented show of support for Palestine that has never been seen since the arrival of Zionism to Palestine. The numbers were very small in demonstrations for Palestine up to Gaza. Therefore, I do think that we should believe that that global Palestine is the one that may eventually recruit also more reasonable political elites, financial elites, and economic elites, first of all, to take urgent action to defend the Palestinians from the next stages of the attempt to expunge Palestine as a country, as a people, as a culture, as a history. And secondly, would be willing to understand that the whole vocabulary that was used by genuine or cynical people who were interested in bringing peace to the Holy Land was wrong. There's no need for peace. What there is need for is decolonization. What there is need is transitional justice. And more than anything else, there's a need to listen to the Palestinians and hear them. What are their aspirations for the future of Palestine? And start with them and let them be in the driver's seat and tell us how they view the future of Palestine. And I'm sure that you all know that they wish to reconnect it to the Arab world. They want to see the refugees and their descendants coming back. They want to see equality. They want to see democracy. They want to have normal life that have been denied to them for the last century or so. I do believe that this will happen. I do believe that this, in the long term, there are already indication that the global Israel and Israel itself is not sustainable in the long run. But I am worried about the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, I do admit. I hope we can all be alert and have the best way of using any kind of politics that we have to tame it, to limit it. But we should think about the future as harboring justice and liberation and freedom for the people of Palestine. And with it, I think a lot of other struggles for injustice in the Arab world and beyond will also benefit from such a vision. Thank you.
Q&A. I wanted to ask you, Professor Pape, about Britain and the whole thing going on with Palestine Action and just the brutal way that they prohibited speech around Palestine and arrested a bunch of people who are on hunger strike and some of them in very delicate health because of that. I wonder if you could tell us any more about that. It sounds like England is getting just as brutal in its treatment of Palestinian resistance as the United States with university students.
Definitely. I think that, like in some other Western European countries, the demonstrations for Palestine gave a pretext for some sections of the government, especially in the security services, a pretext to curb freedom of speech. We've seen it after 9/11, a similar kind of attitude. It's kind of gives them an excuse to say that there's too much freedom of expression, exploiting Islamophobia, the pressure of the pro-Zionist lobby in Britain to show action. I do think that they got themselves into trouble with the Palestine Action by so quickly proscribing it as a terrorist organization. I don't think they expected that the society would react in such a way. I mean, most of the people they arrest for raising signs of support of Palestine Action are between 70 and 90 years old. And each one of them requires 25 policemen to escort them to the car and from the car to the police station. I think I have a feeling that the Supreme Court, the High Court in England, would eventually interfere, but it will take some time. But nonetheless, that doesn't change the fact that this is still a cowardly behavior, and it doesn't matter whether you have a conservative government or a Labour government that still believes that supporting or at least being indifferent towards what Israel is doing serves its interest. There's also fear of the United States here as well. It goes back to what I said before. I don't think these are local battles between people who fight for freedoms and people who want to curb them. I think it's very global, and each of these governments that uses demonstrations for Palestine as a pretext to curb freedom of expression is doing it for the same reason that other governments are doing it. And we should look for an international alliance, because in some countries the local alliances are not strong enough to face that kind of dictatorship and lack of respect for our basic civil and human rights.
It seemed to me you went very fast from the rise of what you're calling New Zionism in Israel to a kind of assumption that that's going to prevail from now on. And I wondered why you went so, why you didn't seem to consider the idea of a moderate Israeli pushback and retreat from the current genocide.
Because I'm spending much of my time also in Israel, and I can see it with my own eyes. So it's not just an analysis from afar. This is knowing the beast from within. I do see that the younger generation, and that is what is important, the younger generation has graduated from education system that can only lead it to support the neo-Zionists. There are very few young people on the other side. Yes, you still have people in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who want to preserve the old Israel. But they usually have dual nationalities. They have jobs that they can reignite elsewhere. That's why we estimate that 500,000 of them already left. So instead of fighting, they're leaving. So that's one of the reasons I don't think that there will be a counter-Israel. And more importantly, their leaders have nothing to offer as an alternative. And that is what is worrying. If they had a bold position that says, let's rethink about this whole relationship between us and the Palestinians, between the river and the sea, they might have had created a counter-Israel. But they still want to square the circle. They want to be what Albert Mami used to call the leftist colonizers. They want to be colonizers, but nice colonizers. They want to be ethnic cleansers, but to be progressive ethnic cleansers. This is not working. It didn't work, and that's why most Israelis said, well, that's much better to decide whether we want to be a racist state or democracy. We prefer to be a racist state. So these people don't have roots in large sections of the society. Demographically, they are not growing. They are important for the economy, for the academy. But you can read the Haaretz today. The academy is being totally drained because people don't want to stay. I don't see any potential force that will fight back in an effective way, nor does it have a vision that could really prove to people that they have something else to offer. None of these people who are now supposedly being the alternative condemned the genocide. They don't call it the genocide. None of them has done anything to protect the Palestinians in the West Bank from the terrible ethnic cleansing operation that Israel has committed. And all of them are complaining that the world is against them. This is not an alternative. So I'm afraid we've reached that position where there is no dynamics of change from within. And the only way of growing a proper alternative Jewish voice inside Israel is only once, I think, decolonization would start it. It's not a precondition for decolonization. I say it with I'm very sad to say it. I'm an Israeli Jew. I don't want it to be like this. But that's That's the only way I can see it working. I do hope that international pressure and regional pressure would be enough, and there was no need for violence to do that. That depends on the region and the international community. There's a way of changing it, but the way does not go through creating an alternative inside Israel, but first of all, punishing Israel for what it's doing, and then maybe you can begin to see something different developing. That's the historical moment we are in it, and we have to recognize it. I point out to discrete mini-revolutions that each one of them by themselves would not change the reality on the ground, but together, when they will fuse together, they will have a transformative effect. That's my judgment as a historian from the way a regime changed or states disintegrated in the past. One of them is the implosion inside the Israeli Jewish society, and we already talked about it, the takeover by the Judea state, the state of Judea of Israel. This is going to weaken considerably Israel. The other one is the vision of having this kind of Israel means that Israel would have to have an economy of war for another 10, 20 years. Economy of war that stretches over decades is not sustainable in terms of the state's ability to take care about the needs of its own society. Much depends on the American taxpayers now for that kind of militarization in front of a future that is only full of conflict and bloodshed. But one wonders if the American taxpayers would continue to pay the huge sums of money, and they would have to be much higher than they have been until today to sustain the state of Judea and its ambition. So I think that even Republicans in America might have second thoughts about whether Israel is a liability or an asset. The other one has to do with the fact that the younger Jewish generation, including the United States, disassociate themselves from Zionism. And then you have the international community, not only the societies. I do believe that there will be a transformation that will begin to affect political elites. As Noam Chomsky puts it, the movement between B and D, the boycott and divestment, to the S, to the sanctions. I also think there are currents, undercurrents in the Arab world that would create a very different political reality and can create different reality in the Arab world that would face Israel not with small guerrilla armies, but a far more formidable challenge that I think together with the other pressures might have an impact on its policies and identity, and the identity of the regime. And finally, I would just mention quickly, one is I do think that the younger Palestinian generation is far more united, less fragmented compared to the present political polity of Palestine. And I do believe that they have a potential of putting a very different vision for Palestine that the world will not be able to ignore. So all of these and others, as I say, not by themselves, but I do believe that together they are mini revolutions, I call them. Some of them do not depend on us. Some of them we have a very important role in making them come true.
Question for you. Are you able to travel to Israel, Palestine?
Yes, so far I am. I'm not able to teach. I'm not able to enter schools. But yes, I'm still able. I don't know how long they're going to do this with this particular government. There's no telling. So yes, the answer is yes. And this is particularly important for me because of what I call the forgotten Palestinians, the 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel. We haven't talked about them, but they are also under a policy which is callous, inhuman, and it's a different kind of oppression, but a very terrible one. And I'm very happy if I can still be with my friends and colleagues and comrades there to do all we can also to help and defend this particular community of Palestinians, as I say, 2 million Palestinians that usually are not talked about, understandably maybe because what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but they're very important, and they will be very important for the future.
You were just listening to Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He spoke in January 2026. Ilan Pappe has been called Israel's bravest historian. He's the author of many books, including A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuc, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and for his book, A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Community Church of Boston. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oud Virtuoso, Marcel Khalife, Birds of the Galilee.
Destructiveness of AI all around us every day. Fake news, job loss, alienation, depression. Well, they tell us how AI is going to cure cancer and solve the climate crisis and improve our lives every day. I'm not seeing that. What I am saying is so much AI slop in the internet, I can't tell what's real anymore. AI is the most dangerous technology in the history of mankind.
That's Kuhan Pakmander, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kuhan Pakmander on the nuclear legacy of artificial intelligence. AI, artificial intelligence, is an inflection point for humankind. Most people are uneasy about AI. In one poll, 71% of respondents said they thought AI posed a threat to humanity. Right-wing pundit Matt Walsh says, "We're sleepwalking into a dystopia that any rational person can see from miles away." And then he adds, "Are we really just going to lie down and let AI take everything away from us?" Bernie Sanders warns, "There's a very real fear that in the not-too-distant future, a superintelligent AI could replace human beings in controlling the planet." But for the tech bros and their corporations, AI is a goldmine. Who will speak for those who worry about the dangers AI poses and want to see it carefully regulated? Our guest today is Kuhan Pakmander. She's a journalist, author, and peace and environmental activist. She is co-founder of the Tech Critics Network, and her articles appear in The Nation, The Progressive, and other publications. She spoke in Hawaii in December. And now, Kuhan Pakmander.
I'm astonished that there is one issue that I am totally in agreement with Steve Bannon on. Of all people, Sloppy Steve has said that AI is the most dangerous technology in the history of mankind. Truth is, I couldn't agree more. If the earth will not end with a bang but with a whimper, maybe TSL
started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those